From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it is day six of the partial government shutdown over funding for a wall along the Mexican border. No signs yet that either side is ready to budge on that issue. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is under renewed pressure after that death on Christmas Eve of an eight-year-old boy in federal custody. Let's bring in Enrique Acevedo, anchor and correspondent for Univision. He's in Mexico. Enrique, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
I remember when I went and did the show from Mexico City last year that every time President Trump would mention the wall, the peso would drop in value. How is all of this playing where you are in Mexico?
Well, by now, I think that people here in Mexico have really moved on from this discussion. They really don't pay much attention to the political discussion right now in Washington. They're more concerned with whatever's going on this side of the border, the crisis in Tijuana, the thousands of Central American migrants that are arriving every day to the border with the United States, and the solutions that the Mexican government, the new administration of President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is coming up with to try to solve this humanitarian crisis.
And do you think that part of that solution is going to be that Mexico stops some of these Central American migrants from coming into Mexico?
All the governments involved, Jeremy, should view this as a humanitarian crisis, and all of them have neglected this as such. I think that Mexico should, if we're trying to solve this from a tactical standpoint, we should come up with a solution that allows immigrants to stay in Mexico, I think, for a while, to receive a humanitarian treatment while they're in Mexico. And on a more strategic dimension, we should start working on combating the root causes of immigration, the push factors in the communities where these people are coming from. That's the only viable solution. First, trying to solve this humanitarian crisis, and then stopping immigrants from arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border in the future.
Many of them fleeing violence in their own countries in Central America. Meanwhile, Enrique, U.S. Customs and Border Protection has ordered medical checks on all children in its custody after the death on Christmas Eve of an eight-year-old boy from Guatemala in the agency's care. Here's the CBP Commissioner Kevin McAleenan speaking with CBS this morning.
With any death in custody, we report immediately to our Office of Professional Responsibility and the DHS Inspector General. Both of those independent investigative arms have responded and already interviewed the father, and they'll be pursuing an investigation into the circumstances around this tragic event.
Enrique, this is the second death of an immigrant child in the agency's custody this month. What does it tell you about the state of immigration at the U.S. southern border?
The U.S. is using a chainsaw for a job that requires a scalp, Jeremy. This is not a national security crisis. This is a humanitarian crisis. What's a fact is that in the last 10, 15 years, the profile of the people arriving on the border has changed dramatically. It's not just immigrants from Mexico trying to look for a job on the other side. It's people like this boy and his family and other families, especially women and children that are arriving from Central America at the border, and then they are seeking to legally request asylum. So we should be adapting to this reality instead of just throwing more money and more military and law enforcement resources at this.
But what does that mean to adapt to it? Because on the one hand, you can't really expect the CBP to be able to handle an influx of people who may be arriving with potentially life-threatening illnesses. And you also can't expect them to just release everyone so that they don't have to deal with the consequences of whatever happens.
I agree. I think the CBP does an incredible job of securing the border. Most of the CBP agents, the Border Patrol agents specifically, do a great job, and they have saved many lives. But there's also the case of Border Patrol agents, not doing their job well, or even falling into some sort of a criminal activity, like cross-border shootings, like excessive use of lethal force. So I don't know if the CBP is the agency that should be by itself dealing with this humanitarian crisis. We should be really working with Mexico and the Central American governments, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, what's been going on in these countries, and the role the U.S. has played historically in that region too. But we should be working with them in a comprehensive strategy that stops people from migrating to the U.S. As long as we don't do that and we just focus on closing the door once people show up at the border, we're going to have more caravans and, I'm afraid, more stories like the one we just learned about.
Enrique, as we close out 2018, are you surprised that, even though I bet that the story of immigration has been one of the top stories in this country for almost half the days in this year, that we don't seem to be any closer to a solution?
I'm surprised because, there's a lot of people in Congress that I've reported on this over the years that understand that we need comprehensive immigration reform. We need to deal with the people who are already in the country without documents. And we need to deal with the push factors like we've been discussing. The system is just not working. The extremes have taken over the discussion, the debate over immigration, Jeremy. You're either for open borders or you're for family separation. And everyone else, all of us that are in the middle and that just want common sense approach to this, have been hijacked by both extremes.
That is Enrique Acevedo, anchor and correspondent at Univision, joining us from Mexico. Enrique, thank you and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Jeremy.
Well, now a look at how one form of alternative energy is growing. Seven states have wind energy projects underway that in the next few years will double the total amount of electricity that wind turbines can generate. And Wyoming, the largest coal-producing state, is among them. This surge in development comes after a decade of almost no wind power growth in that state. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports on the turnaround.
On a vast swath of prairie lined with 79 wind turbines, new blades are being delivered on the backs of 18-wheelers. Lane Anderson navigates the snow-packed service roads. He oversees all wind operations at Rocky Mountain Power, part of PacifiCorp. He parks under a massive turbine.
We're at 7 mile 409. This is our first test turbine for repowering.
This whole wind farm is getting repowered. New equipment will allow the same turbines to increase production by 20%. And it's not the company's only project. Rocky Mountain Power is developing 4 new wind farms in Wyoming to be finished by 2021. Anderson points to one new site in the distance. It takes a second to make out the tall white turbines.
Our Dunlap wind site is over there in the distance. Over there at Dunlap, TB1 and TB2 will be on the north and south side of that wind plant. And Ecola will be right in between this site, 7 Mile, and Dunlap.
With these 4 projects, plus 3 more from other entities, Wyoming will more than double its existing wind energy capacity. 6 other states are also on pace to double capacity, including Arkansas, New Mexico, and Maryland. That's according to the American Wind Energy Association. It's the latest push of what's been an upward trend in the past few decades for wind. In 2009, wind was less than 1% of total generation across the U.S., according to the Energy Information Administration. Now, it's 5 times that. Robert McCullough leads an energy consulting firm. He says the reason for all this growth is low costs.
It's much easier to buy power on the open market than maintain an elderly coal unit. We're seeing that all over the United States.
A report from Lazard, a financial advisory firm, shows the cost of producing wind has gone down by nearly 70% in 9 years, sitting at prices dramatically below coal. Low prices are pushed even lower thanks to a federal tax credit that's set to end by 2020. Uday Varavadajan is a principal at Rocky Mountain Institute, a nonprofit focused on clean energy.
There are a lot of other states that are trying to figure out a way to put as much wind in the ground as they can.
With more and more demand from states with renewable standards and declining costs, he says it's hard for states like Wyoming to avoid new projects.
The question is, do you want to take that opportunity or not? And if you don't, it's getting harder and harder to say that you don't want to take that money from the people who want to buy your wind.
Wyoming hasn't been eager to embrace wind. If you live here, you know it's windy. The state is the 7th highest wind capacity potential, but it sits at 15th in installed capacity, according to the Department of Energy. And until this surge, growth has been stagnant. One wind developer says it's not easy to do business in the state. Paul Martin of Intermountain Wind says that's due to lack of transmission, which will soon change, public opposition, long permitting times, and a tax on wind, which only one other state has. Varavadajan explains the challenge.
I think Wyoming, more so than many of the states surrounding it, has not necessarily been a friendly place for wind to be developed.
State Senator Michael Von Fladern from Gillette, the country's coal capital, says he has seen a lack of support at the state level. That's because it's felt like wind energy is supplanting coal. But with such good prices and coal on the decline, legislators have to figure it out.
You know, our customers demand it. We got to comply in some manner. We can't stick our head in the sand and try to say you'll take coal or you'll take nothing.
Back at the Seven Mile Wind Farm, Lane Anderson and Rocky Mountain Power see Wyoming as a home to world-class wind. And he says that's not going away.
I believe the renewable resources will be moving into Wyoming a little more readily in the years to come.
For now, wind power developers and their investors will watch the Wyoming legislature for signs of just how long the current surge might last. Lawmakers are expected to vote on a bill that would raise the state's tax on wind power sometime next month. For Here and Now, I'm Cooper McKim.
And now a story about finding happiness even under the grimmest of circumstances. Heather Harpham's 2017 memoir begins with the birth of her daughter Gracie, who was perfect. Heather was so happy, though devastated that Gracie's father Brian, a much older writer, made it clear he didn't want to have children and he wasn't there. But pretty soon, Heather couldn't worry about that because her newborn was not perfect. Something was very wrong with her blood. And in a dizzying cascade of events, Gracie was whisked away. Ultimately, Heather was told Gracie would require blood transfusions just to stay alive. Brian came back into the family fold. He and Heather were told Gracie could have a life-saving bone marrow transplant and it would be best from a sibling, but they decided against having another child. Then fate intervened and Heather became pregnant, and by chance, that child's stem cells did save Gracie through Duke University's Pediatric Blood and Marrow Transplant Clinic. This is a story of happy accidents and some gut-wrenching decisions. The book is titled Happiness, The Crooked Little Road to Semi-Ever After. It was recently released in paperback. We spoke with Heather Harpham when the book was first published, and I began by asking her to tell us, what exactly did Gracie have?
Gracie had a blood disease which manifested as an inability to sustain red cells in circulation. It was never diagnosed. It was a fluke, a mutation. But the situation we were in ultimately became clear, which is that she was a child literally dependent on the kindness of strangers, meaning she had to have blood transfusions in order to survive.
And what would happen is that she would just become, as you wrote, she would become like a rag doll.
Yes. In the very beginning, I never had a newborn before. I didn't know what to expect. And so I just thought she was a kind of dozy, super easy, sleepy baby. But my mom was alert to just how inactive and inert she was and made sure we got back to the doctor.
Now, Brian is not there yet. You are in California having the baby. We'll skip ahead. You cocoon with your mom, terrific friends and family. He eventually does come into the fold, but you've got this thing to work through. You're still both now together dealing with a sick child, but you've got this lingering resentment that he wasn't there at the beginning.
Yes.
How do you resolve that?
First of all, you have to want to. And we don't always want to. I really wanted to. And Brian really wanted to. We both wanted to bridge the abyss. And there had been a connective tissue that remained between us, a connective thread, even when we were quite estranged.
Yeah. Well, then there was also Gracie. You both cared so much about her. As you write, a baby from central casting, really quite something, but with a time bomb inside. You and Brian, you write another point, had made someone with an expiration date. Because as she's getting older, you're finding out she could stay with the blood transfusions and live to 30 or have a bone marrow transplant. And the best matches are from siblings, although that's not a guarantee. But you were told you could do as some couples have and have another child to harvest their umbilical cord stem cells at birth to replace Gracie's.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the decisions and the thinking you had to do there.
If you have one sick baby, the absolute last thing you want in this world is a second sick baby. And because we had no diagnosis for Gracie, we couldn't be given clear odds. And so we made a choice not to do that. And then luckily, Gabriel, our son, had other ideas and
that was incredible.
Made his way into this world.
You became pregnant again, kind of like by accident. So you didn't have to make the decision. Couples have made, you know, let us have a child to save the life of another child, to collect stem cells. You didn't have to make that decision because along came the child.
It was made for us. Right. Yeah, exactly. Along came a child.
But you then had to decide, do we go forward with this transplant?
The mortality risk for pediatric bone marrow transplant is quite high. The lowest that we were getting was a 10% mortality risk. And you're taking that up front. You're taking it right now. It's not a question of what will happen to your kid 15 years in the future. It's a question of will they survive this treatment right now.
Brian comes up with an incredible image. Because of the statistics, he says, imagine 10 little toddlers crossing the street. Only 9 get to the other side. I mean, that's what he presented to you. Do you mind reading from that point in the memoir, describing this debate you were having?
I'd be happy to. If transplant was a huge risk, so was doing nothing. When I thought of Gracie's future without the transplant, the screen filled with silent gray snow. I could see her at 4, maybe 5 years old, but that was it. Beyond that, she wavered out of sight. My gut feeling was that she needed this cure to survive. If we left her sick, I felt sure she'd get sicker. Failure to thrive. She could dwindle down, sputter out. He was afraid she would die if we transplanted her. I was afraid she would die if we didn't.
You decide to do it.
Yes, we do.
And then you move to the planet of people who are having stem cell transplants for their children. You enter this netherworld, literally go into a place where other families are doing this. Describe that.
It was stunning how ravaged, honestly, many of the children looked. Mm. It almost felt like being among beings who were experiencing things you don't see humans experience. I mean, things powerful enough and painful enough to transmogrify the body. And that was very sobering. Mm. It's one thing to decide in the abstract to take your beautiful little, you know, skipping 3-year-old daughter to cure her. And it's another to see kids who are in the middle of a brutal, brutal process.
Knowing that one child isn't going to make it across the street.
Those may well have been Gracie's odds, you know, 1 in 10 mortality risk. Our actual lived experience on the transplant ward was of a much higher risk level. Mm-hmm. There were 16 rooms on the ward where Gracie was treated, where she spent almost 2 months. By the time we left Durham and we'd been there 10 months, I could name a child from every one of those rooms who hadn't made it. Mm. And that was really hard to carry home.
Mm. And hard when you were there. I mean, Brian didn't want to get as close to the families that were there because he knew, you know, some of these parents are going to be shattered. You did, and were shattered when some lost them. And meanwhile, your little girl, who is just a trip, starts getting deeper into the process and becoming one of those transmogrified, you know, losing her hair, losing any energy. She's having her bones emptied of their marrow.
That's right. You're being hollowed out like a straw person. At the same time, and she did go, I don't want to be blithe about what was really, really terrible, but there was this extraordinary spirit to observe in her, and I saw it in other kids too, this gorgeous lack of self-narration, if you will. Like, she could be so sick to her stomach, and then she'd wipe her mouth, and she'd pick up her ponies, and she'd go back to playing. Mm. And I was thinking, you know, if I'd been sick on that level, I'd be talking about it for a week. It would be the story of what was going on. I just can't believe it. I felt so sick. I was so sick. She just, like, that was then. I was just sick a minute ago. But now I'm going to motor my bed head up and the foot up, and I'm going to play around in this little valley that I've made out of my bed. You know, you look for whatever silver linings you can. That, for me, was one of those lessons, like, hey, pay attention. You don't have to attach yourself to the story of how terrible this is. You can actually just try to live it moment by moment by moment.
And you do. There is a happy ending. There's actually a scene, both Gabe, you know, the little brother who gave his stem cells, and Gracie, who received them, are back in the hotel, and they've fallen asleep together. As you write, her fingers curled around his thumb. They didn't stir. They were busy doing the covert work children do at night, the multiplication of cells, the silent, unstoppable growth, the hatching of private plans. What I can't imagine didn't seem to you in that moment like a miracle. She's growing.
Yeah, it did. It still does. She's a beautiful young woman. It's both an absolutely ordinary reality and an astonishing, beautiful fact.
The book's title, Heather, Happiness. You take time throughout to try to decide what that is. What is that now?
You know it when you feel it. It's, of course, by nature, totally ephemeral, and it doesn't always come as the result of some perfect set of circumstances. It just doesn't. You can check off all the boxes and be miserable, or you can be, at least for a moment, on a pediatric intensive care unit and have a little exchange with your baby that brings you joy. Mm. So, gosh, I don't know.
It's a crooked little road, as you write. Heather Harpam's memoir is Happiness, the Crooked Little Road to Semi-Ever After. Heather, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Robin. It's been a pleasure.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Holiday shopping is important for retailers, but so are the days following Christmas, like today, when people return and exchange gifts. Joining us now is Sucharita Kodali, retail analyst at Forrester Research. Sucharita, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
And how important are these days right after Christmas, as everybody takes all of their stuff back and returns it and exchanges it, for these retailers who want to add to their bottom lines? Maybe somebody goes in and decides they want to exchange it and buy something more expensive.
Yeah. It's quite important. Usually about 10% of all of what is considered holiday sales happens after December 25th. And a lot of it is definitely people returning items. There are estimates that up to half of gifts end up getting returned in some way, shape, or form. And if it ends up being an exchange or some type of a credit that consumers go back and buy something with, that's fantastic for retailers because that just ends up, you know, often leading to some kind of an upsell or additional purchases. But the other big reason that this week is so important is because there are a lot of sales. And this is the opportunity to clear out all the inventory and basically make way for the new year. So that's why it ends up being actually quite important to retailers.
And MasterCard Spending Pulse said this week that retail sales in the U.S. from November 1st through Christmas Eve were up 5.1%. Maybe the best holiday shopping season in 6 years. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, that is absolutely reflective of what's been happening actually through much of 2018. And the great irony is that just last year, everyone was talking about a retail apocalypse. And what 2018 has actually shown is that the consumer is very resilient, that people still like to shop in stores, and the stores that actually continue to remain standing are actually pretty compelling retail experiences for consumers.
So it's not just Amazon that's benefiting.
Absolutely not. Amazon is definitely a big beneficiary and one of the most successful retailers these days. But there are a variety of different companies that are doing well. Some of the department stores are actually doing well. Hmm. Walmart and Target are doing well. The drug stores, the dollar stores, and some of the even apparel stores that are newer, companies like Lululemon, are actually doing really, really well.
Who's not doing well? Is there anybody who's being left behind?
There are, yes. A lot of your older traditional mall merchants, like J. Crew, for instance, unfortunately, are not faring too well in this economy. We've seen the demise of stores like Toys R Us, but other specialty big boxes like Barnes & Noble, I think, are unfortunately struggling.
So we saw a big rally in the stock market yesterday, but it does look like overall for the year, it's going to be down. What does that mean, do you think, for consumers next year?
That's a great question, and there are just so many unknowns. 2018 was a year of fantastic customer confidence. It was a year where there were relatively low gas prices, and every dollar lower in gas prices usually adds $700 back into every American household's pockets, which often gets spent in discretionary purchases. And we don't know what gas prices are going to be next year. We don't know what tariffs are going to potentially do to consumer goods next year. We don't know what the stock market's going to do next year. What we do know is that we're in a period of a lot of volatility. And it is likely that the good retail year that we saw in 2018 is probably not going to be replicated. Retail is cyclical. When we have an up cycle, you can usually expect a down cycle not too long after.
That is Sucharita Kodali, retail analyst with Forrester Research. Sucharita, thanks and Happy New Year.
Thanks. Happy New Year to you, too.
And now let's talk retirement. You or someone you love may be looking at it and asking, what's the difference between a pension plan or a 401k and an annuity? Well, company pension plans require you to contribute over time. They invest the money and at retirement pay you back in a lump sum or monthly checks. Annuities you buy in one lump sum, usually at retirement. Then they send you checks as well, but all the plans are different. Some say they'll pay you back for life, but wait, how much will that cost you in fees? Some let you take your money back, some don't. And while pensions are guaranteed by the government agency, the Pension Benefits Guarantee Corporation, if your company fails, you get something back. Annuities? Not so much. These are things you might want to think about as you go to your steak dinner. People of a certain age are getting postcard invitations to free steak dinners with a little financial advice on the side. But there's a sales pitch on the menu as well. New York Times finance columnist Ron Lieber's 80-plus-year-old aunt got one, and like many, they had her at the words New York Steak. Ron joined her at dinner and now joins us to talk about annuities, which can be great if you do your research. Ron, welcome back.
It is nice to be back.
And you wrote you'd long wanted to attend one of those steak dinners. Because why?
Because nearly everyone I know who lives in a zip code of average affluence and who is of a certain age gets these pitches. They get them for reverse mortgages. They get them for estate planning. And they definitely get them for the retirement portfolios. And there have been a lot of warnings over the years about some of the bad things that happen in some of these meals. So I wanted to see it for myself.
So tell us, first of all, you get there. There is steak. That's true. And there's also an insurance salesman.
So the first thing to know about these meals, if you're inclined to go just for the free meal, is that they have names for people like you. They call them plate lickers. So I got there, and the very first thing I noticed was there was a poster at the front of the room talking about something called equity index annuities. And my heart sunk.
Hmm. What is an annuity, and why would your heart sink?
Well, an annuity at its most basic form is an insurance policy. It actually comes from insurance companies mostly. And what annuities attempt to sell in various forms is guarantees. And often they are guarantees against what many older people fear the most, which is running out of money. Now, the way in which they deliver on that guarantee, I mean, there are 100,000 different iterations of these things. But the equity index annuity is known for delivering very high commissions to the people who sell them. and being extremely confusing. And so as soon as I saw that, I knew we were in for it.
But overall, an annuity is you hand over a sum of money to these companies. In exchange, they tell you that they will, you know, give your money back either in checks at some point or in lump sum at the end. So people who are afraid of putting their money in stocks, as you said, afraid they're going to lose their money. This seems to be a guarantee that they'll get their money back, don't they?
It depends on the type of annuity. There are two different types. There are the kinds where you can buy a regular paycheck, in effect buying yourself a pension, or you can buy yourself a guarantee that a sum of money that you turn over will earn a certain return and will be guaranteed not to lose anything. Both those things are enticing right now at a time when the markets are moving up and down and fewer people than ever have pensions in the first place.
Right. But beware of that guarantee of how much money you get back and how much money your money's going to make. Hold that in mind as we continue on what happened that evening. So you see that this is going to be about some form of annuity, heart sinks. Then you see the host is a man named Arif Halabi, who, with a simple Google search, you discover what?
Well, I discovered that he got in trouble with some California state regulators several years back for having talked one of his clients into yanking a whole bunch of money out of his home's equity and putting it into speculative real estate in Costa Rica.
Something you might want to know before you go out to dinner with Mr. Halabi. But then you look more closely at some of the material that he's handing out to the people there, including your Aunt Tilly, which is not her real name. And you look at the small print. They're selling this annuity as being better than an investment in stocks. And you see what?
They were comparing an old type of annuity that actually doesn't exist anymore with how the S&P 500 index of stocks would have done over that time period. And what I figured out right away in the teeny tiny fine print that a 65-year-old probably could not have seen without a magnifying glass, I could barely make it out in my mid-40s, was that they were not counting the dividends that stocks throw off that you could reinvest. And I did some quick calculations under the table with a calculator and realized pretty quickly that if you had included the dividends in that comparison, the stock index would have actually done better than the annuity.
Far better.
Far better.
33% better than the annuity. So what happened? You approach Mr. Halabi. You also approach the company that he seemed to be working for. What were you told?
So I went back to see him first thing in the morning at his office. I thought we were going to be having a sort of reasoned intellectual debate about the reinvestment of dividends and what the right comparisons were. And instead, he accused me of, you know, showing up under false pretenses. He insulted our profession and my institution in particular. And then when I started asking him about the run-in he'd had with the state regulator several years ago, he showed me to the door and kicked me out of his office.
Okay, so that went well. Then you contacted the annuity company. He is selling these annuities for a company.
Correct. So the chart that he was showing off said that the data came from a particular insurance company. When I talked to the insurance company, they said, oh, that's an outdated chart. He's not supposed to be using it. And we actually inform our independent agents when it's time to retire materials like that.
Okay. As you write, after you wrote the column about being thrown out of the office of an annuity salesman, you were inundated with requests to find out more about these annuities. And you also have questions that people should ask, and they included one I had. What happens if you die?
There are certain annuities, even the simpler ones, where if you turn the money over in exchange for a paycheck for life, if you die, all that money's gone, right? Now, if you want your survivors to get some of that money, or if you want your spouse, if you have one, to continue getting a check, you can do that, but it means that your initial payout will be lower. The more complicated the product is, the more your head starts to spin.
You say one of the questions, what are the circumstances under which I might not get back the money I'm handing you? What part of the contract might limit or change how much money I eventually receive? What can change during the term of the contract? Can you please provide a list of all the fees I'm paying? So those are a lot of the questions. Where do you come down on annuities versus investing your money in the stock exchange, which hasn't been doing that well?
I think you can actually have a reasoned debate. And there are plenty of people out there in investing expert land who used to hate annuities as a matter of course, who are actually changing their minds about some of them now. There are circumstances under which certain annuities might perform better than, say, a bond fund would. So I try to remain open-minded about all of this. But the one thing I know for sure is that all of this is incredibly complicated. Many people who sell annuities make it complicated on purpose. And it is not the customer's fault that these things are so complicated. And everybody in this industry ought to be in the business of communicating much more clearly.
So is there something about the steak dinner being involved with a sales pitch that worries you?
The only thing that worries me is that people feel like, you know, once they've passed the cheesecake course, that they're under some obligation. And in fact, there are bulletin boards filled with annuity salespeople that sort of tell you what the ratios are, right? If you send a postcard out trying to get people to come to your office, you know, less than 1% of them will come. If you invite them to a steak dinner, it'll be 1 to 1.5% of the attendees who will come to a follow-up appointment. If it's a really good steak dinner at the fanciest steak restaurant, you might get like 3% of them to come, and then maybe 25% of those who come to your office will end up doing business with you. They work. So you just have to keep in mind that they're trying to lure you in, and you should be very careful about going in and turning over a large sum of your hard-earned money to somebody who, at the end of the day, is just trying to sell you something.
There's more on the menu than you might think at that steak dinner. Ron Lieber, he writes the Your Money column for the New York Times. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And Ron's steak dinner column begat others, including the most recent on how people are trying to make annuities live up to their promise. A way to hand over a lump sum of money, keep it free from the stock market, get a check back for life, and ensure that the insurance company who sold you it will be there as long as you are. It's great information. We'll have all the columns at hereandnow.org.
Ten years ago, most of us hadn't heard of subprime mortgages, but they ended up almost tanking the U.S. economy. The next big risky investment could be low-grade corporate debt. CNBC calls it a $9 trillion corporate debt bomb. Joining us now from New York to explain is The Wall Street Journal's Sam Goldfarb. Sam, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so first of all, let's just explain the terms. What is low-grade corporate debt?
It's debt borrowings by companies with low credit ratings, with so-called junk credit ratings, companies that have a non-zero chance of going bankrupt as opposed to, you know, your apples of the world.
Non-zero chance meaning what?
Well, it actually does depend quite a lot on – it's a fairly wide spectrum even within the junk spectrum. So there could be so-called double B companies like Netflix that are actually quite large and stable, down to heavily indebted, riskier companies that really do have a chance of going bankrupt within like the next year.
And these companies used to take out loans directly from banks, but then in the 90s, the loans started getting chopped up and sold to investors. Sounds sort of familiar. Who's investing in them?
Pretty much any type of investor that you could think of, pension funds, mutual funds, hedge funds, sovereign wealth funds.
And do they know that they're getting into something pretty risky?
It probably depends. You know, I would think that the pension funds and sovereign wealth funds, for example, would be pretty sophisticated. As far as your average person, they might have heard that these are the safest kind of debt because they are so-called at the top of the capital structure, meaning that in a bankruptcy,
they get paid out first.
Exactly. But even for leveraged loans, the recovery that investors are going to get is probably not going to be, you know, 100% of their investment.
Now, usually when there's a very risky bet that somebody's making, there is also a lot of upside potential. They could win big with this investment. Is that the case here?
It's not really the case. I mean, as is the case with all types of debt, what you get in return is a steady interest rate. So in some ways, you know, you might like that because with stocks, you don't necessarily get even a dividend. But with stocks, you do get that big upside of, let's take an example of Tesla. If Tesla does great, you will share in that amazing growth. But if you buy Tesla bonds, which do exist, the most you can get is, you know, a 5% interest rate. And the worst you could get is hurt in a bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm. So what is the larger economic risk from this? If there is a bubble of low-grade corporate debt, could it be as catastrophic if it bursts as subprime mortgages were?
I would probably say that most experts would say that it won't be as catastrophic, but it could have a similar dynamic because unlike with homeowners and consumers in the post-financial crisis period, consumers and families have kind of retrenched to some extent and are less leveraged than they used to be or at least have kind of kept it at a stable level. There really has been a big increase in borrowing by businesses. And so that naturally is where people are looking to now and are worried about.
And so they don't want to invest anymore in these low-grade corporate bonds?
Well, just in the past couple of months, there has been a retreat by investors. And it is a big question about whether that's, you know, just temporary or a more lasting problematic thing. To some extent, it has to do with people lowering their forecasts for economic growth next year. And then there's just this general sense that we're due for a recession.
Right. So if there is an economic slowdown and if the stock sell-off continues and if investors start pulling out of this low-grade corporate debt, doesn't that then make the problem a whole lot worse because companies are going to have less money? They might have to lay people off or certainly not hire or make investments.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I'm biased because I cover corporate debt, but I sort of feel like it does have this very direct impact on the economy that, you know, stocks steal all the headlines. But just, for example, in November, these low-rated companies borrowed the least amount for a single month than they have since February of 2016, which was another period when people were fairly worried about a recession.
That didn't happen.
It didn't happen, right? So, you know, easily that could just be we could just have a repeat of February of 2016, which a lot of your listeners won't really mean much. But the concern is that if that continues, we just have another month and another month like that, that's definitely not good for the economy.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, of 10 being the most scared and 1 being the least, where would you say people are right now about this as an issue that could really be a problem for the economy?
On a near term, I would say that the concern is probably maybe a 4. Mm-hmm. In a bigger picture, when people are actually looking at the expansion that we've had, the concerns of a bubble preceding this pullback, then the concerns are more like a 7 or an 8. Mm-hmm. That like even if the bubble isn't bursting now, at some point it should, and that probably won't be good.
That is Sam Goldfarb of The Wall Street Journal. Sam, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.